Science Friday is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Bonobos have a reputation as being the calmest, most peaceful of the great apes.
I saw like two bulls of fur running in the trees one after the other, and the other one was screaming, crying, and I was like, what is going on? And the field assistants were not surprised. They're like, oh, they're just fighting. That's an aggression.
New research involving thousands of hours of observation shows that chill reputation may not always hold true. It's Thursday, May 2nd, and you're listening to Science Friday. Bonobos are a species of great ape, along with gorillas, orangutans, and chimpanzees. Recent work published in the journal Current Biology finds male bonobos may be just as aggressive as male chimpanzees, if not more so. Guest host Ariel Duham-Ross talks with Dr. Maud Mugino, postdoctoral associate in the Department of Anthropology at Boston University, about that work.
Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. So for listeners who might not have all their great apes straight, who are the bonobos and where are they found?
Bonobos are one of our closest living relatives with chimpanzees. They can be found in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So we say that they're an endemic species, which means it can only be found there. And there is around 15,000 left. When we look at a tree, we have humans, and right next to them, we have a branch, which is what we call the pan branch, which group bonobos and chimpanzees. So they are as close to us as chimpanzees are.
How did they get this reputation for being so peaceful, and how did that reputation persist for so long if it's not quite right?
That is a great question. I think it started because the first time researchers saw bonobos, there's a lot of behavior that were not observed in chimpanzees, such as intergroup interactions. So in bonobos, group of bonobos can encounter, they can spend time together, share food, sometimes sleep together in trees, groom together. And in chimpanzees, group of chimpanzees cannot encounter. They will always avoid each other or probably aggress each other. And also in bonobos, male do not coerce female, which means they do not push female into mating with them. And we don't observe infanticide or killings in bonobos compared to chimpanzees. And I think all those behavior gave that perception that bonobos are peaceful.
I see. Okay, so what made you want to look at this question in the first place?
There is a different thing that make me want to look at it. First of all, there is a study that came out in 2017 that looked at reproductive skew, which is inequality in reproductive success among males. So that means you can have high reproductive skew where some males are going to sire more offspring than others. And usually, if we have high reproductive skew in a species, that means there is high context competition between males. So males are going to fight between each other. And this study compared bonobos and chimpanzees, and they found that there was higher reproductive skew in bonobos compared to chimpanzees. So the question was, how do bonobos obtain such high reproductive skew if they're not so aggressive? So we wanted to look at actually rate of aggression among those two species. And that sounds pretty basic, like why is it hasn't been done before? And there is actually only one study that looked compare directly bonobos and chimpanzees, but they did not use the same sampling method on the field. So for us, we're like, okay, let's do this by using the exact same method on the field from the start, so we know what we compare.
I was really struck by the literal years of observational data that your team had to gather to reach these conclusions. Can you tell me about that? How did you get these data points?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if we start with chimpanzees, we are at Gombe National Park. So it's the Jane Goodall site. So there is 60 years of data. For bonobos, we started to get good data from 2019, which is a lot less than what we have for chimpanzees. It's actually hard to get good male focal follow. So focal follow is when you follow one individual throughout the day. And when you do that type of study, you want as much as possible so you can have a lot of variation. And for this, that might ask to actually get 2 years or even more of data. So that's why we have those numbers.
So let me get this straight. You would get up and literally follow around one bonobo all day just watching what this male did.
Exactly. Yes.
How long were your days and what was that like?
So for me, all the data we have are actually come from field assistant mostly, not from my own data, because I haven't spent 2 years, unfortunately, on the site. But yeah, usually we might spend 12 hours. So we wake up at 3:30 in the morning, go start your day at 4, try to join the bonobo around 5, because that's the time they wake up. And then you follow them all day until they go back to bed, so in their nests in trees. And this, they're probably going to end up there around 5 p.m. So that's a pretty long day at the end.
Wow. All right. So what exactly did your team observe over the observational period?
So they observed a lot of different behavior. Personally, the first thing, when I arrived on the field, my first week, I would always remember, it was like still pitch dark, so I couldn't recognize really the individual. And I saw like two balls of fur running in the trees one after the other. And the other one was screaming, crying. And I was like, what is going on? And the field assistants were not surprised. They're like, oh, they're just fighting. That's an aggression.
When we say that male bonobos are just as aggressive as male chimps or even more so, what exactly does that mean? You know, can you quantify that?
Yeah, so we have some quantity. We observed that male bonobos act 2.8 times more than aggressively than male chimpanzees. However, we have to keep in mind that when we compare things like this, it's a little bit too straightforward. That's why we have statistical analysis that allow us to control for between individual variation, group variation, number of males also in the group. But even with the statistical analysis, we observed a difference between the two species.
Okay, I see. So chimps are notorious for their aggression, right? Both males and females tend to fight with other members of their community, and they do so pretty regularly. They can also recover from those fights fairly quickly in terms of their relationships with the chimps that they have fought with. They're known for making up, they reconcile, and even console each other. Are bonobos the same? Are they different? What did you observe?
Actually, for reconciliation, that's studies that are still going on right now. There is one study that looked at it and they found a lot less reconciliation among bonobos than chimpanzees.
Really?
Yeah, at least among males.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And it kind of also makes sense if we look at how dynamics works in the society of bonobos and chimpanzees. In bonobos, males are very individualistic or more individualistic in their strategy. They do not form coalitions of males. So they tend to fight. And if they act aggressively against each other, they know the costs and the benefits of each aggression. In chimpanzees, the dynamic is very different because males make coalitions within group fight, but also for between group fight. So the cost and benefits of aggression is different, and then the process of reconciliation are not going to have the same benefits.
Okay, right. Because there are structural differences between these different species, right? In terms of how their communities are built. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. In chimpanzees, male form coalitions. Female rarely or not do so. And male are dominant over females. So male will form coalition for within group fight and to do border patrols and some time to time, some killing raids if they see like one or two individuals by themselves. In bonobos, it's totally different. Male rarely or do not form coalitions, but female form coalitions, and they do so sometimes against males. And both male and females in bonobos are co-dominant. So it's a total different dynamic.
Which might explain some of the differences, but it's interesting that you found similarities. So you were looking at individual actions of a few apes from specific ape communities of bonobos and chimps. Can you extrapolate that out to an entire species?
It's actually one of the things of this study is that we compare only one side of bonobo with one side of chimpanzees. So the main idea is that it would be really nice to have more sites to understand better the variation. What I can tell from this study is that we think that they use aggression differently because of those different coalitionary patterns. So because male chimpanzees form those coalitions, when they act aggressively against another male, they might face a coalitionary retaliation, which is very expensive. It's very risky. On the other way, if there are a lot of male chimpanzees acting against one male chimpanzee, then the costs are lower. But in any case, when they act aggressively against a member of their own community, it's costly because this member might have been a future partner for between group interactions, so defending the group. So aggression in general is less predictable and more expensive for chimpanzees compared to bonobos. So that might be why we observed this difference of rate of aggression between the two species.
Meaningful for you to be able to conduct a study on them?
So yes, there are only 15,000 left of them, or this is what the IUCN has evaluated. And we don't really know exactly the number because they're so remote in the rainforest that it's hard to get an actual predictable number. And I think research on bonobos really allow us to better understand them and then to better protect them. For example, at the Kokoloi Bonobo Reserve, it's a reserve, so allowing us to really protect this species or a group of bonobos, which is really great to protect them from poaching or for environmental destruction. So I think research are really important, and I'm happy to be part of such research to help also protect the species.
So what's next? Where do you go from here with this research?
So from here, my dream research would be to actually get more study, more field to do the same analysis with their chimpanzee group or bonobo group, so we can get a better understanding of the variation between species, but also within species in terms of aggression. Also, for me, I was really interested in the dynamic between male and female. If we look at the data, they're very opposite. In chimpanzees, male act aggressively against females, but females tend to avoid to act aggressively against males. In bonobos, it's a total different dynamics where female act aggressively against males, but male tend to avoid acting aggressively against the female. And I'm really interested in that dynamic.
All right. Well, I hope you get to do that kind of research in the future. We'll be keeping an eye on that.
Thank you.
Dr. Mood Mugino is a postdoctoral associate in the Department of Anthropology at Boston University. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for your time.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I hope to open the conversation about working parents a bit. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier, to find out how they balance being a dad with a successful career. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
One year ago, we launched our podcast, Universe of Art, which features stories at the intersection of art and science. And to our surprise, a lot of you wrote in to tell us about your own science-inspired art projects that you're making in your spare time. For this week and the next, we're going to feature some of these listeners for Universe of Art's one-year birthday. Dee Peterschmidt, who hosts the show, talked to one of these artists who embedded with scientists in the field for many seasons to make his work come to life.
My name's Todd Gillens, and I'm a visual artist, and I do mainly temporary public projects. people encounter the work not actually knowing why it's there or that it's artwork. They just see something that's a little different than what they expected.
But when Todd started working on this one project, which took 9 years to produce, he knew the only way he could finish it was by diving into the science.
I really wanted to understand, not just at a superficial level, what water does in the landscape.
Todd worked with the city of Reno, Nevada to create a mile-long poem printed on its sidewalks that border the Truckee River, which is fed by the melting snowpack from the nearby Sierras. He'd been thinking about sidewalks and how they're like streams in the mountains. Both of them are narrow channels that direct the flow of water or people, with life flourishing along the way. And for him, poetry was a way to immerse a passerby in a stream of words, letting the flow of the poem carry them through the city's connections to the nearby mountains, like a leaf caught in the flow of a river. But he didn't exactly know how these stream channels change a landscape.
I wanted to understand this process and what was actually going on there so that when someone's reading a piece of the poem, they can imagine what had been there in that very spot before urbanization and also what is still going on in the mountains just adjacent to the city.
Here's a part of that poem called Confluence.
Lightly on a slope of stone, a trickle sounds, and some small flying insects sip and celebrate the drop of temperature, moisture, puffs of moss in hand-sized pools. Enough, as cracks conduct through centuries of snow from reservoirs within the mountain rock.
Todd needed to do some research, but he is not the kind of person who just phoned that in.
And I specifically wanted a scientific approach, like I could have read the literature on mountain streams. I really did not know what I was getting into. I was really very innocent, but it wound up that I spent 4 years, 4 field seasons, surveying streams with a couple of different teams of scientists.
Todd just started showing up at field stations run by the University of California in the Sierras. He talked to whoever was there and pitched himself as an artist working on a public poem, but also as a researcher with his own scientific questions.
And they were really welcoming. They had work to do, but they were also really pleased to share what they were doing.
He got in contact with a couple other groups and basically became another member of these teams, helping them carry equipment on 3-hour hikes into the mountains, banding frogs in Yosemite. And eventually he found a team that was experimenting with constructing concrete stream channels in the Sierras.
They were as fascinated with what I was doing as I was with what they were doing. But I was really there, like I was a double agent. I was, you know, supporting them in their science. And they were like, I wonder what Todd's going to come up with. And whenever I had a question, I could say, hey, what about this? And they could show me through the microscope what was going on. And then I could reflect that in words and images. The slopes chime gently as a liquid earth flows by beneath the dry. But here and there, the arid and the wet will cross, revealing that which we call moisture, spring, brook, river, flow. Another chance to name and know what surfaces can hide or clarify and what goes on below.
After writing the poem, Todd created a custom font that was printed in bright yellow on contact paper, kind of like a bumper sticker, into 9-foot-long strips about 6 inches high. It took him and a handful of art school graduates about 3 weeks to install it on over 6,000 feet of Reno's curbs.
Somebody commented that they came across the piece and they started reading, and before they knew it, they were 3 blocks out of their way. So that was really what I hoped for, was that the work would engage someone in the physical act of walking, of being in the city, and at the same time engage their imagination in the regional environment and the dynamics of how water shapes landscapes.
Confluence will be on Reno sidewalks until September. And you can check out photos of it on our website. That's at sciencefriday.com/sidewalkpoem. I'm Dee Peterschmidt.
And that's it for today's episode. Lots of folks helped make the show, including
Jason Rosenberg,
George Harper,
Kathleen Davis,
Shoshana Buxbaum,
and many more. Next time, Ira checks in on some of the week's news in science. I'm Sci-Fi producer Charles Bergquist. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.